Life is made up of decisions. Some are large, some are small, and some are uniquely individual, and some are thrust upon us. Either way, the decisions we make at these critical crossroads determine the direction of our life story. Welcome to our podcast, If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. By sharing the decision-making process of highly successful people in their own lives and what they have learned both about decision-making and the importance of considering the alternatives, we hope to help you make better and more productive decisions in your life. This podcast will help you consider all your decisions through a new lens. My name is John Kramer, and along with my partner in crime, my brother Paul, we will interview a wide range of successful friends and acquaintances to understand the decisions they have made in life and what they have learned both about decision-making and the importance of reflecting on the process. If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror, is brought to you by Industry Intelligence, providing decision-making solutions at your fingertips. Welcome to our podcast, If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. Thanks for joining us on our journey to identify the decision-making process of interesting and influential friends and acquaintances. Well, none of us probably thinks about how we think through the decisions we make, given their impact on our lives. It's something that we should probably take more seriously. So, for example, if you were to go on Amazon and search for decision-making books, you'd find over 3,000 of them. A Google search will turn up over 120 million. So our goal is to help you understand how to make better and more successful decisions. So with that in mind, let's start with a question. Have you ever thought about your decision-making process? Should I have lunch at Burger King and McDonald's? Or should I have fries or fruit with that burger? More like, should I leave the job I love to move across the country for a new opportunity? Or should I invest $250,000 in 3 years of my life to go to law school? Would it surprise you that 44% of lawyers regret their career decisions? Or that 50% of teachers quit their jobs in 4 years? Clearly for them, they were not good decisions. The key question that we're going to be hoping to uncover is if there is a decision-making framework or construct, a way to better assess the alternatives on the table. What we will be doing is setting out on a journey of discovery, speaking to interesting people about their experiences. Our contention is that every one of us has a fascinating story made up of many decisions over the course of our lives. It's the sum of these decisions that dictate the direction of our journey. And that's what we're trying to uncover. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Andy Murray. Not the Andy Murray of tennis fame, the winner of Wimbledon, but the Andy Murray who, from my perspective, might not be quite as famous, but significantly more influential in all of our lives. I've known Andy through competing against him in business for over 25 years. Truth be told, his company, Thompson Murray, kicked our asses all over Arkansas. However, during all that time following him, I've really never had the opportunity to sit down and speak with him face to face. So you're in luck today, as Andy's journey is a fascinating one with many important decisions that led to dramatic changes in direction. Andy, welcome to our podcast. And in keeping with our listener promise, do you have a construct, a roadmap that you follow while making important decisions in your life?
Well, thanks, John. Thanks for having me on your program. It's a real treat. The topic that you are talking about is near and dear to my heart. And I've really thought a lot about this topic a lot because I've had a lot of career changes from Procter & Gamble to DaySpring as a completely different career direction, to starting a company from scratch, deciding to sell it to Saatchi & Saatchi globally, and then Walmart, and then the UK. So it's quite an eclectic career of different different routes. And for me, I had to face that intersection multiple times around what should I do this or should I not do that? And there's been several frameworks I've used depending on the situation. of what to do and why to do it. One of the biggest decisions I ever had to make was, should I sell my company or not? And I enjoyed, as you know, working in the industry with some great people, great competitors like yourself. And it was when you birth that yourself, it's a really important important decision for an owner. And when I started the company, it was really a kitchen to, you know, sold the house, sold the furniture, sold everything and cashed in a 401k. And it was all or nothing moment, an all in moment. And at that time, at 33, with two kids, it put myself in a position of commitment that I had crossed a Rubicon and needed to go big or go home. I mean, it was like you had to make it work versus a side hustle. And so the very first thing I did was create a 3x5 card at the kitchen table and stuck it on the refrigerator. And that card says, my dream is to build a great company, and then define five things that defined a great company: great culture, great people, great clients, great role in the community, and then a great financial performance. So those things all had to work together. Fast forward several years, that was in late 96 to 2004, when we were growing and Procter & Gamble wanted to take the idea globally, and we were just here in Northwest Arkansas and a couple of other cities and was still self-financed and had to make a decision. P&G called and said, we're going to tender, thinking about tendering Shopper Marketing globally, and we're concerned about the implications it might have on you. You probably don't have the scale to go globally, but we want to take what you're doing here and make a global partnerships. So that was a really interesting time. And to sort through that decision, which had two options to it, obviously I would have to sell to a larger holding company in order to get the scale we needed and be able to keep that business, which was a big part of our business, P&G was at the time, or keep it private and may or may not, you know, you don't know where that's going to go. So what I did to think that through was I got an executive coach, a consultant type person, and I recommend this anybody just get, you know, that it's a good advisor, a good strategic thinker, to not just think through it yourself, but someone's going to give you some good feedback. And I asked him to arrange 10 meetings, five with CEOs that were further along than I was. All 10 had to be, but maybe 100 million in sales or such. Five that had chosen to keep their company, and five that had chosen to go through that process and sold. And I wanted to go meet them. And he arranged a 2-week trip in the summer of the late summer 2003. And we went on a road trip to go talk to those guys. And I wanted to compare notes. You know, did you regret the decision you made? Because I saw, or were you very happy with it? Because I saw that they were all on a roadmap that was further down the road than I was. And if I could talk to someone that was further down the road, and a group that had taken one fork and one had taken the other fork, I might get some shared insights to inform my decision. Because I didn't want to regret it later. And I came back with that 2-week-ish type trip and sat down with my wife and we talked about it. And I said, look, you know, here's the only thing I can figure out. There's two types of people in the world. There's builders and there's owners. And the guys that were owners, they kept their company and they seemed all very happy. And the guys that were builders had sold and they seemed very happy. So the end of the road of that is they're both very happy. The question is, are you a builder or are you an owner? And my wife went back and found that 3x5 card that had been done, I don't know, 9 years earlier, or not that much, but 7 years earlier, and came back and said, yeah, I'll support what you want to do either way, but the card says your dream is to build a great company, not own one. And so going all the way back to that moment, it gave me a lot of clarity that, yeah, this is what I really started out to do, and it made the decision quite simple. So that process of getting some expert advice, looking down the road further to somebody else that maybe made some choices, have enough people to talk to give you some insight on where that direction of travel might take you.
So really what you're saying is that you looked at outside influencers, mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of tried to build a network of input, yep. That helped you on that decision. Yeah. So based on that, have you followed through on other decisions that you've made similarly? Because that's an interesting construct and one that we really haven't heard before as we've talked to people. And it's something that I believe quite strongly, is that the network is critical. I mean, your network is sort of your lifeline and your connection to your business world and your personal world. And that being able to really build that network, cherish that network, nurture that network is critically important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, John. I mean, I think your network is everything. And to tend to that network carefully, be a good friend, return calls, invest in that network, keep those connections strong, is so critical over time. And with tools like LinkedIn, it gives you a way to stay connected to people. And if you see someone that you've known, go in and make a comment or connect with them, send them a message every now and then saying, how are you doing? Keep those networks alive, because they do, and not for selfish reasons, but they do come back and return many, many times over. And it, when you're facing a big decision, you're able to tap into that network and get some advice.
Today, more than ever, you need to find the right information quickly and easily. Weeding through everything available is like drinking through a fire hose. Industry intelligence is like having your very own research assistant. The first place I go when I need to access data and insights for a client project or a new business solicitation is Industry Intelligence. Using their powerful patented technology and unique approach to information gathering, curation, and editing, they put everything I need in one place and serve it up in a user-friendly interface. Why not put a data and insight solution partner at your fingertips? For more information, call Chuck Bolcom at 920-891-5496. That's 920-891-5496. And now, for Rearview Mirror listeners, Industry Intelligence is providing a special offer, a 30-day trial membership, absolutely free, when you mention our podcast. So give Chuck a call today. Tell him you're looking for a way to make better decisions. Industry Intelligence, decision-making solutions at your fingertips.
So that's really sort of a construct that you came to late in life. Really what I wanted to focus in on is some of the decisions that you made as a young man. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was interesting as I went back and researched your life, you came out of college, you wanted to go work for P&G, mm-hmm. but yet you couldn't get a job there because of the training and the experience you had in college. So you said, okay, I'm going to take a left-hand turn and get there through the back door.
That's right.
And as a young person, that was pretty intuitive. Mm-hmm. And the thoughts behind that is something that I thought our listeners might be interested to know.
Well, yeah, P&G didn't recruit on our campus. And that was a challenge because they pretty much filled all their open positions at that time. This is back in 84 from college recruiting. And it's a promote from within business. And living in Cincinnati, I wanted to work at P&G. And so, yeah, I chose EDS, who at that time was owned by Ross Perot, because it offered the best training and development and was recognized for that for young engineers in computer science. And so it fit that profile. And I never really thought about EDS as a long-term place, but they really had a great program for the first 2 years in that was pretty competitive. And so, and recognized as a great program. So getting there, even though it was less money than I'd hoped to be making, it provided the training and technology support to help you really grow. And I wasn't there for probably 12 months or 9 months. Through a network relationship of one of my family members to a person at P&G, I think it was my dad said to this guy, an engineer, actually, my son's really interested in P&G and he's working at EDS and just out of college. And you think you might be able to get him an interview. And so I got a call from P&G through relationship, really, to say, would you like to come down for a day visit? And I said, yes. And went through the whole day visit process, except for the last interview, which was the most important interview with the VP over that area. He was like, well, you know, you haven't been properly recruited from the day visit, from the college bit, and you haven't gone through all the testing that they typically do. So he refused to interview me. And fortunately, the four or five other interviews I'd had that day ganged up on him and said, no, you really ought to talk to this guy. And so I had the interview with him, and he said, yeah, and get a same day offer. So I never would have dreamed it had worked out that way. And that's the other thing I think is important looking back. And I say to, I mentor a lot of college students with the Walton College business here. And that is, if you treat the main important, I think, thing to think about at that college age and first two or three assignments out, is that if you approach life and the direction you want to travel as a puzzle, the first thing you do is form the edges, and then you spend the rest of your time trying to figure out what fits inside that box you've created. And the unfortunate thing is you really don't know what's going to come down your way, and it's too early to form that box. And so I've always felt the best decision-making approach or best way to think about it is as a mosaic. And with a mosaic, you start in the center. What are the core values you really care about? And then you start adding the pieces, and the edges are always fuzzy. And so as you build out from the center out, it causes you to think about things differently. Because when you get a puzzle thing going, you're kind of always wondering if the thing you're working on right now is the thing or not. And are you going to get stuck there? Or do I need to pivot and go do something else? But if you see life as a mosaic, then every moment counts, and you get really into the moment versus being distracted and being 80% committed because you think maybe there's something else out there you should be doing. And so I think that idea of being in the moment causes you to pay attention to every single conversation as important, and it lets you be really good in that moment. If you get good at that, then in everything that happened to me happened through network relationship, everything. Everything happened, from starting the agency to some of the first clients I got to going to Walmart. It happened by being in the moment and then seeing that puzzle piece show, or a fragment of stained glass show up, and then fitting it in. And I don't think you have to really know where these careers are going to go until you get to the end, perhaps retired, and you step back and look at it and say, wow, that was a pretty cool experience. And so, and I don't know what your experience has been, John, but I haven't met many people yet that in the mid 50s could look back and say all these things were intentionally designed from when I was in the late stage college and early stage career.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think that you're starting to start to build a framework in my head anyway, that starts with a network and starts with relationships and starts with really nurturing that. But then the second piece of it is sort of looking at that mosaic of what your life is about and starting to build out the pieces from that. So I think that really what was, you know, was interesting is that, you know, you're in Cincinnati, you're working at P&G, you got to where you want to be. And then all of a sudden in 92, they go, hey, Andy, we'd like you to move to Bentonville to work on this little company called Walmart. Now, back in 92, Walmart was not what it is today. There was a very different vision. If I remember back to 92, it was about, you know, low cost, low price, and it was about low cost, and it was about low price. And at the end of the day, they wanted two things, low cost and low price. And then you go and move to Arkansas. Now, Bentonville then was nothing like Bentonville is today.
No.
And that, I have an ongoing joke with my wife, which is, boy, you love Arkansas. And she gets up and runs as far as she can, as fast as she can.
Yeah.
So the decision to pick up, which I assume was a family at that point,
yeah,
of some sort, and move to Arkansas is a big one. And what was your thought in terms of doing that?
Well, this has been a pattern for me even before the Arkansas bit, which I think is an important principle. When I was working in Cincinnati, I was interested in taking a Jackson, Tennessee plant assignment, okay? And I did that before the Fayetteville assignment. And all of my peer group said, why do you want to go to Jackson, Tennessee? You're going to be out on the fringe. And to get promoted, you need to be in the elevator at P&G going up and down and running into executives and be seen and be connected. And that's where the heartbeat is. And I didn't see life that way. I thought the best place to do great work was away from the center. The innovation was going to happen on the edges, not in the center. And I was right about that. And I went to Jackson, Tennessee, and everybody said it was the biggest career mistake ever. And yet we were able to do some stuff with mid-range computing and bring it into the plant that provided information systems they didn't have before. And it ended up getting a lot of execs coming to there. And when they came there, they were very focused on the conversations they were having with me versus being, you know, someone in an elevator in the home office. And so that created way more exposure, I thought, because I was able to do something innovative. You can do that when you're away from the center. So the idea going to Fayetteville was in part because I knew they were doing some innovative things. They had an innovative leader there, a guy named Tom Muccio, who was fascinating. And Tom was pioneering the Walmart P&G relationship. Was, even though that all those things you said were true, they were doing some pioneering stuff. And so I wanted to go there. And again, all the peer groups around there, so you don't want to do that. You're going to get, you know, you're going to get lost in the weeds. But funnily enough, when I joined in there in 91, 92, P&G was bigger than Walmart. Now everything's changed. But in that time period, a lot of execs, the first thing they did was come down to see that, because Walmart was still the largest percentage of their business. And so you had the CEOs paying homage and coming here. And for me, it was like, get out on that fringe and build something and be innovative. And so that's why I chose that very, very strongly. And it turned out, we ended up staying because, as you know, probably better than anybody, there's 1,000 CPG type companies here that have big offices. And when I opened and started the agency, it was like, because there wasn't anybody here and it was perfect. It was hard to recruit people, but outside of that, it was a space to innovate. So maybe the idea behind what you're getting at is innovation happens on the fringe. And if you can get to that, if that's what you care about, then go find the fringe.
Yes. Yep. We could talk about the P&G corporate culture for hours, and maybe that's the topic of another decision for another day, because I've got some pretty strong points of view about it. And frankly, yeah, I've never heard an articulation like you just made about the P&G culture and how to fight the culture. Mm-hmm. And win by building a very different approach to that culture. So, you know, I'm giving you a standing O, although I'm not standing at the moment in thinking that through. I've pretty much followed the Thompson Murray journey and the Saatchi & Saatchi journey. I did want to sort of touch on the decision to sell to Saatchi & Saatchi, because as I understand it, your first reaction to management there was NFW, as we say.
Yeah.
And I'm running. But then it all came full circle. What was the thought process there?
Well, the first time I ran into Saatchi, I was with Kevin Roberts, the CEO. He was down visiting the P&G team, and I was just introduced to them, to him. I came over for a workshop he was running to just have a conversation. And at that time, he was like, why, you know, should we do something together here? They were paid with a big percentage based on sales bonus, how they drew the sales. Well, as you know, what happens at Walmart and retail drives a lot of P&G sales. And so he was not that interested. I was interested in seeing how I could work with them differently or find, you know, ways to get more growth for myself. But he's like, man, I like you where you are. Sit there. And if we do buy, you know, do something with you guys, then he described a world that I wasn't quite wanting to do. And he said, I like you where you are because I'm still getting paid the bonus and I don't have to own you for that. And so there was no real incentive for them to do that. So I walked away from that conversation pretty discouraged, and it was pretty tough. And I let it park for probably a year to almost 2 years from the first time I met him. And during that time, Walmart continued to grow, obviously. Jim Stengel started thinking about shopper marketing in a much bigger way, globally and such. And all of a sudden, when Jim Stengel called and said, when we want to take this thing globally, you know, he made a phone call to Kevin and a couple of others and said, you might want to take a look at these guys more seriously, because they are, this is something we want to have globally. And that really rang in Kevin's ears. So he jumped on a plane from Paris and flew to Arkansas, and we talked about it and got to know each other in a different way. And that decision was probably made in an hour before we started talking financials or anything. And we just talked about conceptually, what's your dream? And he had a very clear understanding of me being an entrepreneur, and understood that I needed that space to do that, and had a framework to go do it. So that worked for me. And it was about not jumping into it too quickly, pausing, let a little bit of time kind of work its way, and not be too rash, and keeping open to what possibilities could happen.
I got two more things I want to talk to you about, because I've always been fascinated, at the same time frustrated, at sort of the two ends of the equation. I mean, I've always been an agency guy. I've always worked internally at agencies. I recently, in recent history, had the opportunity of working on site at one of our customers when I was at WestRock, and realized quite quickly that I never would have been successful in a corporate environment. It just didn't fit, for more reasons than I can even want to start to articulate, but I was worse than a fish out of water. So here it is, you go from the agency business, running a global organization, and then go to work at Walmart. Now, from my experience with Walmart, they're similar to P&G in many ways. Very structured, there's one way to do things, and you're gonna do it our way. That does not sort of fit the Andy Murray personality that we've talked about, of being on the edge, looking at innovation, all of that. That seems to me to be a struggle fit for a guy like you.
Well, you're not the only guy that had that thought. The guys that were hiring me at Walmart had that thought too. So just a little bit of that backstory to see how that works. So I'd retired basically after taking Saatchi X globally and transitioning that over. I took a bit of a break, and I started to do some stuff with technology in the cloud, and hired a bunch of guys, created this little brand called Mercury 11, which was a great way for me just to get back into some of the technology stuff. And I was working away at that, had built up a software platform that helped with retail and Facebook and some other things like that. It was an expensive proposition to get started, but I was been into it and had got it to a good place. And I got a phone call from the Walton College business, where the Center for Retailing, the keynote speaker that was supposed to speak 2 days in the future, called and was sick, couldn't make it, and they needed a keynote speaker. And they had obviously gotten pretty low on the list. It's hard to get us keynoted 2 days notice. And I lived here, so it was like, okay. So they called and said, well, let's see what Andy's got. And I'd spoken at that conference many times over the years, but I hadn't been in the thick of it for a while. And so what do I have to say? So I said, sure, I'll do it. And took 10 3x5 cards and just wrote on them 10 things that I wish I knew about technology when I was in that agency supplier retail space more, that these guys might want to know, because I've been going deep into that for a year. And I presented that. And what I didn't know was the CMO of Walmart was in the front row. He called me a couple days later and said, I heard your talk. You're doing some cool stuff. Would you like to come up to Walmart and do what you're doing to help us get more digital and the creative and marketing space? I did not see that coming. And so I thought about it, and the real question, we had two questions. Can I sell my company and that I had built, invested in? That ended up being fairly easy and sold to Shoptology and Charlie Anderson and those guys. But then the second question was, could I make a difference? And I thought a lot about the whole journey we've been on. So you think, how cool would it be to do the supplier side, the agency side, and now the retail side. And that was pretty unknown to me. I mean, I'd seen it like you had seen it as a call-in on retail or whatever, but to be on the inside and see that. So I thought I could do anything for 2 years, but boy, will I learn something about the total customer journey and how the whole thing really works. So I got in it. And actually, it's not that hard to innovate in some of those bigger companies. I did some of the same principles, found some skunk work things, kept things under the radar, be able to make some progress before you pop up. And they were ready for that at that particular moment. So it was only supposed to be a 2-year assignment. And I did get to the end of that 2-year assignment and was thinking about what's next. Do I want to stay in? And an opportunity came to go be the chief customer officer at Asda. For them, and do another 2-year thing. I said, well, here's a real, talk about going to the edge. This is going to another country. It's like, I've never worked in internationally. Wouldn't that be cool? And so I did that, which I thought would be a 2-year assignment and being a 4-year assignment. I tell you, John, big corporations, they are desperately trying to do innovation or get entrepreneurs in there. And if you can work through some of the politics of it, and I'd gotten, I guess, a little bit used to the politics because of when you're part of a big holding company as an agency, there's a lot of politics. It's still, it still feels like a big company at times. So it wasn't a total shock to the system. But I did decide after I left there, I would never work again in a big corporation. So that line has been drawn, and I have an empathy for your point of view.
So this has been really inspiring for me and hopefully for our listeners. I have to end with one question. Looking through the rearview mirror with 2020 hindsight, is there anything that you would have done differently? Is there anything that you learned that would have dictated different directions in your life? How do you feel about? I mean, it's almost after the last half hour of talking to you, it almost seems to me to be a stupid question because we've answered it. But I gotta end with. Looking through the rearview mirror, what did you learn? What would you do differently, if anything?
I don't think I would have done it differently, perhaps. But I think looking back, if I could go back to that younger self and highlight the things that would really be important that I should have paid more attention to, is I do think, and now after I've been, since March, basically in a different kind of headspace, not working for anybody and enjoying life a bit and then doing some work with the University of Arkansas, the power in being able to get off that activity cycle and do some deep thinking and keep your brain fresh. I do think, as we get in these grinds and it sneaks up on us and you tend to underestimate the importance of having that time built into your life more. And so I think I was going full throttle for so long. I would have probably told myself, if I know now, I would have gone back and said, I'll still get the same results. I don't have to buy into that idea that I got to be full throttle all the time. And I put a little bit more time into thinking about things deeper and being able to draw out some more creativity. I think that would have served me well. And it just didn't really discover that until I got off that hamster wheel.
That's great insights. I think that we've never heard that articulated quite the same way. And I think if I were to look back through the rearview mirror, that's probably something that I would say as well, is that we get so focused in the day to day. And one of the things that I've articulated is that the one of the issues. And I'm pretty sure you'll agree after this conversation we just had, is we're always looking out into the future. We've got a meeting in 3 weeks that we're preparing for. We got a big new business pitch. So you're always living in the day after tomorrow instead of living in the today. And what it does is it really forces you to take the eye off the ball in terms of the broader perspective of the world. And more tactically focused on getting over the next hump.
Yep. 100% agree. And one of the things I advise and do some mentoring through the Marketing Academy, I've got 4 or 5 mentors I've talked to. And one of the things that I say to them that they seem to find helpful, I think, is I ask them 3 questions and to focus on 3 questions. And I wish I had those 3 questions back then. And that first question is, what's the most important outcome you're after right now? And you'd be surprised how many people haven't really stepped back and looked at their day and said, what's the most single most important? It's the word single. You've heard of keep it simple, stupid. I say keep it single, stupid. What's the single biggest outcome that's most important to you? Then the next question, and write that out, you know, and share that. And if you get your head around that, because we're getting too many objectives we're chasing at the same time. The second thing is, what's the single biggest barrier to that objective? Get really clear what that is. And then the last thing is, build out what can you do every single day to attack that single barrier. Because it's, if you're thinking about what you're trying to get done and the single barrier to the biggest outcome, if it's something you only look at every week, you know, it's not going to work. People that train for a marathon, when they get into the training, it's every single day. And pro golfers, every single day they're hitting balls. And so I think if it's really important, I'd focus on it more and I'd look at it and I'd say, I'd choose fewer goals. I'd make them really clear and I'd make sure I'm working on that goal every single day.
That's fascinating because I articulate the same exact thing, I think, mm-hmm. very differently because I'm a simple guy. It's objective, mm-hmm. strategies, tactics.
Yeah.
What are you trying to, and that's really the structure that I follow.
Yeah, 100%. And my only build on that would be make sure those tactics aren't something you look at every week, but do it every day.
Yep. Andy, I got to say thank you so much. This conversation was more than I expected it to be. I appreciate the time. I know you're very busy, and hopefully we'll get a chance to follow up and down the line and share with you some of the decision-making tactics and processes that other folks have come with. So thank you very much for spending time with us on our podcast.
It's been my pleasure, John. Hats off to you for taking on this initiative. It's a really worthy cause, and so very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. Each week, we speak with interesting people, exploring their decision-making processes to understand how these change their lives. Check out our past guests at www.rearviewinsights.com and click on the link to listen on iTunes. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate us, and leave a comment. Until next Friday, this is John Kramer, wishing you insightful and successful decision-making.